listeners. This is Allison Rose Levy here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time from the Progressive Radio Network for Connect the Dots. Every Wednesday, we're here to connect the dots between everything that goes on that connects our personal well-being with the health of our communities and our environment and the planet. That's what we talk about each week on the show. And I always talk to different advocates, experts, authors, writers, scientists, a whole host of other people, each of whom focuses on different facets of what we can do to protect health, earth, life, and, you know, a healthy life on earth, and economic justice for as many people as possible, and environmental justice too. You may notice that this week's show is a little bit, got more of a background buzz than we usually have, and that's because I'm recording the conversation we're about to have while I'm at the Pennsylvania Convention Center, where I'm doing some coverage for the Democratic National Convention this week. So if it gets a little noisy or you hear that background buzz, echoing through the great hall that I'm in right now, that you'll hopefully be forgiving because that's the reason. I'm really excited for this week's show to have with us two friends in community and in activism who have played a very significant and wonderful role and are continuing ongoing to do that in New York State. And I consider them part of my community, my close community here in New York. So we'll be talking today about, I've had many, many programs about fracking. We've had many programs about climate, about the trade deals, and all the ways that those things interconnect. And today what we're going to be talking about is what clean energy, what clean power really looks like and is, and how we can build that out and make that part of how we power our world, run our economy, and live and meet our needs for energy in ways that are sustainable and safe, humane, and supportive of life here on Earth. So my guests on today's show both work extensively on the New York fracking ban, and they're now pursuing these terrific efforts through New Yorkers for Clean Power to create a great power and healthy energy platform in New York State. They are Renee Vogelsang, who is the campaign director for New Yorkers for Clean Power, and Betta Broad, who's the outreach director for New Yorkers for Clean Power. So they're basically, in my community, they're ubiquitous, and they're doing so much terrific good work. And we also ran into each other in Philadelphia this past week for the climate march and activities here, which we'll be discussing a little later in the show. But welcome to Connect the Dots, Renee and Betta. Great to have you with us here.
Thanks, Allison. Thank you, Allison. It's great to be here.
Great to run into you.
We've had a fun week. We'll talk a little bit about that. It's been a joyful week and a sad week and all kinds of different things. I think the joy comes from the community connection with concerned people and the forward-moving steps that we continue to make. Tell us a little bit, maybe Renee, you'd like to begin telling us a little bit of the background. What is New Yorkers for Clean Power? What is the organization? How long has it been in existence? What is it about?
Sure. So New Yorkers for Clean Power, we launched on May 2nd in New York City with Solar One, and you were there, Allison. We were also blessed to be joined by our friend, activist, and actor Mark Ruffalo, as well as environmental justice groups throughout the region, a number of organizations that are convening members of this campaign. So, like I said, it is a statewide campaign focused on facilitating and help expediting the transition to renewable energy, energy efficiency, and electric vehicles across the state. We're started up by groups such as Sierra Club National, NRDC, the Solutions Project, Frack Action, a group very instrumental in the campaign to ban fracking. Capitol Mountain Keeper, another group, a member of our campaign to ban fracking, as well as a group called E2, which stands for Environmental Entrepreneurs, and they're working on our economy, building jobs in clean energy, and building our economy in the clean energy sector. So all of these groups came together, all who've been a part of this transition that we're seeing to get off of fossil fuels onto clean energy as quickly as possible. And, you know, just in how we had to build this big movement, build the political will, you know, build the on-the-ground resources needed to, you know, reject fossil fuels and to ban fracking in New York, you know, we need this kind of effort, this broad effort amongst, you know, groups with resources and expertise to, you know, build this campaign for renewable energy, to go in the direction to renewables, energy efficiency, as well as having clean transportation, which is why we're also focused on electric vehicles. And in addition to those focuses, we're also looking at creating jobs in the renewable energy sector and making sure that this is a just transition, making sure that this is renewable energy by the people, for the people, supporting the communities that need it the most across the state, that this is something that everyone can participate in. And so, you know, we launched with all of, you know, as many folks as we could get to represent that the face of that transition on May 2nd. And since then, Betta and I have been going on the road. We're calling it a Road to Renewables Tour, meeting with people in all corners of New York State, talking about the programs that are in place like Solarize to get panels up on roofs, you know, talking to people about building out electric vehicle infrastructure so we can get more electric vehicles on the road and make sure that they're more accessible to people. And, you know, hosting events to talk about this campaign and what we'd like to do moving forward.
That sounds terrific.
I mean, and I'll stop there. You know, if Betta wants to add anything or, you know, you have a follow-up question.
Sure. Thank you. I'm wondering how receptive, Betta, do you find people to be and organizations to be? I mean, is this something people want? Quarters? Is it, you know, give us an idea.
I think people are very receptive. I think, you know, everybody wants to see a transition to renewable energy and electric vehicles. So I don't think there's a hard sell there, especially not with our community, which includes a lot of fracktivists and environmentalists and people who are concerned about climate change. So that's a pretty easy sell. I think the harder part is really getting these technologies to be implemented in the community, whether it's, you know, a homeowner or a business leader or, you know, a municipal official. How do we take this goal, which is so necessary and there's a lot of support for, and make it a reality?
Right. In other words, individuals are in support, but when it comes to actually making changes in infrastructure, then people have to, you know, kind of construct or contract things in a different way. Monies have to be raised and all of that kind of thing. And people have to, you know, sort of switch their suppliers or, like, tell us, if you would, what some of your actual current initiatives are so we can kind of discuss those in a little bit of detail.
Sure. Well, you know, I mean, I think, you know, as we were saying, like, it's a very important goal, but whether you're an individual or an elected official or a business leader, there are various challenges to implementing these technologies. You know, much of it relates to money. So, you know, how do we make this transition more accessible and more affordable? And when it comes to solar, which is one of our priority issues, there's a couple of ways we're working on that. Renee mentioned Solarize, which is a great model that's really taken off since the first Solarize campaign I worked on 2 years ago in the Southern Tier, which was the second Solarize campaign in the state, and that ended up doubling the number of solar installations in Broome County that had existed previously just in a couple of months. And since then, the model has been adopted by the state. NYSERDA is, you know, supporting a lot of these Solarize campaigns, but really they're relying on the advocacy and activism of local leaders. And how Solarize works is essentially it's a, you know, community endeavor that educates as many people as possible about how easy and affordable it is to go solar by partnering with local installers that have been vetted by the community group that's running the Solarize campaign, often with the support of NYSERDA and other, you know, nonprofits such as Catskill Mountain Keeper, which took the lead in this Renewable New York program that's working in 15 counties across the state. And then, you know, the more people that you sign up for the Solarize campaign, educating them about the federal and state tax incentives, then the more people who sign up, the cheaper it is for everyone because there's this aggregated group buy. So that's, you know, adds another, like, you know, 10 to 15% discount. So there's kind of never been a better time to go solar. And with, you know, a model like Solarize, it makes it more affordable and it also makes it more accessible because it's very complicated, you know, deciding what installer to go with, deciding, you know, how to finance it, you know, whether you're going to buy upfront, whether you're going to do, you know, leasing or loan. I mean, there's so many different things, and the Solarize program really helps simplify things. So Renee and I have been, you know, with New Yorkers for Clean Power, keen on promoting Solarize, getting more community to do Solarize campaigns, and then also building on the success of past Solarize campaigns. So we're really excited about, you know, using the Solarize model to promote geothermal technologies as well as electric vehicles, which are some of the other technologies that the New Yorkers for Clean Power campaign is prioritizing, but using, you know, the success of the Solarize model and building on the existing networks that have been created through Solarize in New York State.
Wow, that's fantastic. You know, there are two things about that that just seem like exceptionally helpful. One is if, you know, an individual has to put it together for themselves, and I've looked into it, you know, there are many different challenging facets to it. And, you know, as you say, and also, you know, you can listen to different contractors and they're coming from different places and there are different companies. And, you know, you're kind of in a new world where you're having to make all these kinds of decisions. And, you know, you don't even know if you're being advised correctly. And sometimes, you know, the quality of the product is important. There are financial decisions involved. So, you know, the fact that there's some kind of guidance as far as that goes and people that have already been vetted and people who are familiar with the process in and of itself is like a fantastic support. And the other thing that's so extraordinary about it is that, you know, the whole incentive of getting more people in the community to participate, that lowers the cost and therefore makes it more affordable for more other people to participate. Because I know that, you know, in Massachusetts, which also, you know, has incentive laws and all of that, my parents had a home in a place where, you know, it's all kind of, you know, wealthy individuals who are, you know, doing it as a kind of luxury thing. And then the more middle to lower income members of the community, you know, are left out in the dark and there's like no way for them to participate. And they're, you know, they have high energy bills. They're, you know, going to natural gas in order to lower them. They're burning wood, which contributes, you know, to carbon in the atmosphere and everything like that, you know, which is a traditional thing that people did that, you know, old hardy New Englanders may have been, you know, used to, and it's in the family and this is what we always did. But part of the thing is that there's no, you know, it's just each individual on their own. So the whole sense of building on, you know, the grassroots community to push this aspect forward is really fabulous. You know, I have a further question. I don't know which of you would want to answer it, but what is geothermal? I think most of our listeners would probably know what solar panels are and what electric cars are, and I'd like to talk a bit more about electric cars as well, but first, like, what kinds of things would be accessible in terms of geothermal, you know, in New York or in New York State? Like, how does that work?
Renee, do you want to take that? I also do want to go back to solar in a minute because there's another kind of piece of this that we didn't touch on, which is community solar, which is really important, or shared solar. But we can we can go back to that.
Well, let's talk about that and then go forward to geothermal. I think, you know, so we can keep the whole solar discussion together. That sounds good.
Okay. So, you know, we talked about Solarize, which is, you know, this terrific kind of campaign that's taken off across the state to get more people aware of solar. And you actually touched on a really important aspect of that, Allison, which is that the individual, you know, acting alone, you know, can find the whole process very daunting. And actually, the average amount of time that a solar purchaser spends before they, you know, decide to go solar is 2 years. So they start thinking
wow.
about it, they, you know, whatever, Googling late at night, maybe talking to some other people, meeting with people, you know, getting a sense of it. And then finally, when they sign the contract, it's now a 2-year process. So, you know, Solarize cuts down on that amount of time. And so saves, you know, the solar companies a lot of the soft costs. But community solar is actually this new, really exciting opportunity in New York State. Previously, before community solar was enabled, you know, only 1 out of 5 New Yorkers were able to go solar for various reasons. You know, maybe you have an old roof, or you have too many trees shading your roof, or you're a renter like me, or, you know, live in a multifamily building, or you have lousy credit, and so you're not, you know, eligible for, you know, the financing for solar. So there was a lot of obstacles. And so now with community solar being enabled, or shared solar, as it's also called as of last summer, the idea is that people will be able to buy into, you know, a large array in the community, or, you know, on the rooftop of a municipal building, or, you know, a big box store. I mean, it really could be anywhere in a big field just outside of town. You know, but really like a large solar array that multiple people can buy into. And again, there's different financing that's available in order to do that, the different models that have been used in other states. But the exciting thing is that it really does mean that at least now in theory, everyone can go solar, whether, you know, you have too much shade, or you're a renter, or what have you. But of course, there's a lot of
obstacles. How does that work? Let's say you have too much shade, because I know that, you know, like if the roof doesn't point in the right direction, you know, then, you know, there's another house in the way, or, you know, like it has to point a certain way, and you live in a place, or you don't own the place you live in. You know, how does the community solar actually work?
Well, you know, I mean, a solar developer, whether it's a private developer or a community developer or municipality, would decide to build a shared solar project. And so you'd have to have, you know, the land or a, you know, huge rooftop in order to build the solar array. And it could, you know, and they could be very large. Actually, in New York State right now, each individual project is limited to 2 megawatts, but you could also have, if you have kind of a large parcel of land and you wanted to do, say, 2 2-megawatt projects, you could also do that. So there's some flexibility in the way the rules have been written for community solar. Mm-hmm. You know, but basically it's pretty simple in the sense that, you know, instead of having to have the solar on property that, you know, you own, you can mm-hmm. get your, you know, electricity from a large solar array that's not on property you own. And so, you know, you're pooling investments from, you know, multiple members of a community and, you know, providing that power and often the financial benefits in return. So we've been working with a group called CoShare, Community Owned Shared Renewables, which came out of the Energy Democracy Alliance, which is the relatively new network in the state working to influence the REV, Reforming the Energy Vision process that's happening right now at the PSC, the Public Service Commission. I apologize for all the acronyms. But basically mm-hmm. what CoShare is looking at is, you know, how do we develop these projects so that they are community owned, so that the, you know, the long-term investment really is benefiting the community members, not just private developers. I mean, we want to see private developers do these projects, absolutely, but it's really exciting to think about, you know, municipalities benefiting in the long run from community solar development, as well as
you know, low-income folks who might not initially be able to, you know, purchase the solar panels, but there's a lot of kind of creative financing models where later on they can actually be the owners of the solar panels. So, you know, it's an exciting moment for sort of localizing our energy system and for democratizing it. And we see that, you know, shared solar has a lot of potential to do that. But of course, the devil's in the details. And, you know, downstate, there's challenges with there not being enough land. Upstate, there's challenges where there's, you know, the electricity rates are already pretty low. So how do you make it financially viable, especially for, you know, low-income folks and municipalities? So there's a lot of challenges, but it's a really exciting moment in New York State as far as, you know, expanding solar and renewable energy for more New Yorkers.
That's really thrilling. I have a question. You know, if the electrical prices are lower upstate, but the land is upstate, is there any way as of yet or is anything on the horizon where the solar could be gathered in the upstate location and in some way used by the downstate location, or is that not really feasible as of yet?
Well, my understanding is that, you know, if I live at the moment in Kingston in Ulster County, and so my utility is Central Hudson. So if I wanted to, you know, buy into a community solar project, it would have to be in the Central Hudson Territory. Whereas mm-hmm. if you're in New York City, your utility is Con Edison. So the project would have to be under, you know, Con Edison's jurisdiction. I'm sure that there are some ways around that and creative transmission that could happen, but I'm not going to pretend to be an expert. Not, but as of right now, it's, you know, you're somewhat limited as far as what utility, you know, you're paying your bill through, where the project could happen. In some places like the Hudson Valley, it's a pretty hot market because you have land and you also have fairly high electricity rates, but then there's like a huge queue, you know, there's a big line where all of these community solar project developers are waiting to hear from Central Hudson, you know, how much are the interconnection costs going to be? Because just because you have land doesn't mean, you know, you're near enough to a substation and, you know, you have the transmission capacity, or maybe you do, but it's going to cost you, you know, $200,000 just to, you know, have that interconnection fee covered for the utility. So, you know, there's a lot of challenges and it's very technical and I think we're all still learning. Everyone from the PSC to the utilities to community advocates are learning how to do this, but you know, there's a lot of opportunity and I hope like this time next year there are tons of projects that, you know, we can channel people into. You know, we're building this awesome network. People who really, you know, want renewable energy. We have tons of, like, our fractivist friends who are already a part of this movement who want to buy into a community solar project. So I think once those projects are online, there'll be tons of prospective customers. It's just a matter of getting them online and then making them affordable and accessible to everyone.
That sounds great. What a great project. So, Renee, any further thoughts or comments about that, or do you want to talk about geothermal now, or what would be good?
Yeah, I think it would be good to maybe transition into some of the other focus issues. You know, so solar, that was a, you know, great assessment and recap from Betta on everything going on with solar. You know, and the thing about geothermal is that we need to, it's critical to look at our electricity needs, but it's also extremely critical to look at our heating and cooling needs. Also keeping in mind that 35% of our greenhouse gases are coming from heating and cooling our homes, whereas 18% is coming from electricity. Upwards towards 40% from transportation. So this is why we have this kind of broad spectrum of priority issues within this campaign and transition, you know, to look at things like solar and wind for our electricity needs, look at things like geothermal for our heating and cooling needs, look at our transportation issues, because all of these areas are contributing to greenhouse gases and contributing to our, you know, our challenge at hand with climate change. as well as, you know, having a clean environment to live in and having healthy, safe, long-lasting jobs. And so with geothermal, you know, it's essentially it's a technology that uses the temperature of the earth where you're installing these coils, these heat pumps, to heat or cool your home through the temperature underground. And so, you know, there's a lot of heat that's stored underground. And it's we're actually working and learning. We are by no means experts in geothermal, but we are learning from our friend Bill Nowak at NYGEO, which is the New York Geothermal Energy Organization. And, you know, they're really the experts, and they're working in manufacturing, installation, distribution, and promotion of ground source heat pumps for heating and cooling our homes and businesses across New York State. And, you know, we feel like it's a critical issue, obviously, this is why we're working on it. And one thing that we would like to do as a part of this campaign is bring this presentation about what geothermal is, how it works, as well, you know, how much does it cost, who are the installers, you know, all of these educational advocacy things that are going on within the solar programs across New York to, you know, to help implement that on the end of geothermal, in addition to helping with advocacy to, you know, make sure that there's the same amount of funding, tax incentives, and subsidies available for renewable heating and cooling. So, you know, this is something that we're potentially looking at working on, working with the state as well as municipal officials, as well as groups like NYGEO to really get this going and advance it across the state, build both the political will for renewable heating and cooling, but also build the on-the-ground installations and getting people directly connected so that they can do this.
Wow, I haven't actually, I guess what happens is if you get the solar power, then it would go into things like mini splits, which is used for heating and cooling, you know, or in other words, electricity can generate, you know, be used to generate heating and cooling, right, like through mini splits.
Sure.
But, you know, I've, of course, encountered people who do that, you know, and they're really happy with it and everything, with that transition. But I've actually never met anyone who is using geothermal. So this is more at the sort of pilot development stage where, I mean, how do they, I don't know if you know the answer to this, but, you know, I would imagine, I mean, how far away are we to a point where it would be, you know, seemingly cost-effective, you know, for this, you know, for the sort of pilot versions of this technology to be built out? And is it inherently likely to be more efficient in the heating and cooling, you know, capacity for cost than, for example, solar electric mini splits currently are?
Yeah, well, you know, we're pretty close to it being fairly, you know, I think currently there's already some support in making it more affordable. There's even more opportunity. I know that a bill just passed in the Senate and Assembly for, you know, tax incentives on this and subsidies for people to go with geothermal. So it's just awaiting the governor's signature. So, you know, I think we're very close to this being something that's accessible, and part of it is just getting the word out to people, connecting them to installers and connecting them to the, you know, the experts who can, you know, educate them and answer their questions on how this all works, the same thing that's been happening with solar, essentially. And, you know, I think... It would be great, actually, probably for you to interview Bill Nowak or someone else, you know, him or maybe one of his colleagues if he's not available with NYGEO, maybe do a whole show just on geothermal, and they could, you know, speak with you in detail about all of this, because it's really fascinating to us and to me.
Yeah.
And It's definitely, you know, it's a way of harvesting renewable energy 24/7 with no need for a backup system. And, you know, the earth itself is the energy storage system. And
yeah, there's something about that that's so incredibly appealing, isn't there?
Yeah.
I mean, and also we're in the Northeast, you know, which is where it gets really cold. And, you know, so we have greater heating needs here than, you know, maybe every other place in the country. I mean, there are other cold areas in the country, but it's definitely one of the, you know, regions that has winter and the need for heating in winter. And in fact, one of the reasons that we've had this dilemma problem of having all of these gas pipelines, which I've reported on extensively on this show, is because they're all going into the Northeast cold region to provide, you know, heating fuel, but at a terrible cost to our climate. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's actually the idea that you're burrowing down into the earth and bringing up heat and using it, and that it actually could be cost efficient is, I mean, to me, that's like really fascinating. Is there a way that the community aspect of it makes it easier to do, or is it really just one of these things where, you know, you can kind of do it and access it and, you know, on an individual by individual basis? I mean, there's no real specific group advantage to doing it, except for, I suppose, if the people who offer the service are not in your region, you know, obviously it's maybe a better incentive for several, you know, a community to have more people doing it simultaneously in terms of bringing in such people, because I wouldn't imagine there's a geothermal expert in every neighborhood.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and also the state, you know, has made a historic commitment to solar with, mm-hmm. you know, Governor Cuomo's New York Sun project program, mm-hmm. which is, you know, basically investing $1 billion over 10 years to stimulate the marketplace in solar and increase, you know, mm-hmm. solar electric, which is, mm-hmm. you know, very successful so far. And I imagine mm-hmm. will continue to be, even with some of the challenges with community solar and making it accessible for everyone. We still are seeing, you know, major increases in solar in New York State, but there hasn't been that type of, you know, long-term large-scale investment in geothermal technologies yet. So that's something mm-hmm. that we really want to push for. There is a new, you know, director of renewable heating and cooling at NYSERDA who is fantastic and has agreed to, you know, speak at events that New Yorkers for Clean Power helps to organize around the state. We have one in the works in Westchester for this fall. But there needs to be, you know, kind of a bigger monetary commitment from the state and also a lot more education and outreach. But I know there's a couple of people I know who have geothermal systems in New York State. They absolutely love it. You know, not only does geothermal enable you to heat your home, but it's also in lieu of a central air conditioning system. So that's really kind of amazing too, is, you know, it's not just heating, it's also cooling. And one family in particular I know in Broome County, which as some of your listeners may know, is really where they wanted to frack first. It was kind of the sweet spot, so to speak, for fracking, but thankfully we don't have to worry about that right now. But this great family I know who are in Broome County and have a farm about 20 minutes outside of Binghamton, they have solar and they also have geothermal. And so, mm-hmm. you know, they're the type of, like, you know, renewable energy pioneers in New York State that we really want to feature in this campaign and enable them to tell their story to other New Yorkers and show that this is possible and it's something that, you know, maybe not everybody can do tomorrow, but that more and more of us can do and, you know, work to make it more accessible for more people, especially when it comes to, you know, the fact that a lot of, like, conversions that are going on, say, in New York City, which I'm sure you know about, Allison, from, you know, the kind of so-called bad oil boilers mm-hmm. to then natural gas, you know, conversions that, you know, Con Edison incentivized. We really want to, you know, not see that replicated in other places. And, you know, instead of converting, you know, big buildings to natural gas and marrying ourselves to more natural gas infrastructure for the long hall. You know, we want to see renewable heating and cooling systems instead. But that's something that's going to require a lot more organizing and also a bigger commitment from the state.
So, yeah, this is all, it's really exciting to think of a future where, you know, we're providing for our energy needs in this way rather than, you know, sort of shooting the climate in the foot, you know, and creating all these terrible problems that, you know, that aren't technologically, you know, necessary. It's funny because I was reporting on my Facebook page this past week that by coincidence, I just was at a gathering of journalists where I got into a conversation with someone from a prominent publication that I won't mention, and environment was not this gentleman's beat. It wasn't anywhere near his beat, nothing to do with anything that he knew anything about. But for some reason, I guess we must have been in that group chatting about the election and everything, and he said something, you know, he asked, I guess, what I reported on, and I expressed concern that the outcome of the presidential campaign would have, you know, some kind of impact on our climate going forward. And, of course, I was concerned that it would be a negative impact and, you know, wanting to see a positive impact. So, you know, so he and I got into a conversation and he basically was like, what do you mean by a negative impact? And I said, well, a negative impact is that we don't intervene in the window to slow down climate change by, you know, continuing to burn fossil fuels until we get at a point where we have destabilized the planetary ecology to a degree that it will be much harder to stop climate change, extinctions, ocean acidification, and these other issues. And so he said to me, well, you don't know, you know, what's going to happen. You can't say that, you know, I mean, we could, you know, like, he basically, I don't think he would have called himself a climate denialist, but he was more like, no one could possibly predict how this is all going to turn out at the end of the day, you know. And, of course, that's true, you know, but what we say in the environmental community is, you know, if the science shows that we're going down a bad road, then let's intervene as soon as possible, which, of course, you know, we've tried to do but haven't been all that successful completely in doing it, although we've made great inroads like the ones you're doing and the, you know, stopping fracking in New York State and others. You know, but let's intervene sooner. Let's intervene now. Let's slow this down. Let's slow down the window of acceleration. Let's make it not happen. And then the next thing this guy said was, I know that human ingenuity can solve the problem and there will be technological solutions. And the thing is, there, what you're talking about, what you're demonstrating through all the work you're doing at New Yorkers for Clean Power, is that there are technological solutions. It's just that they need to be used, they need to be funded, there needs to be more information, they need to be made more accessible. So in effect, he was right that there are solutions, but we can't just continue doing what we're doing and say, oh, one day there'll be solutions. So it's like we need these solutions right now. Let's shift gears a little bit and just talk about the electric cars, because as Renee mentioned, you know, that's also a substantive contributor, our transportation. And so, you know, I mean, when we're talking about electric cars, I mean, I have long known, you know, certain very affluent people or, you know, people, friends from California who have the Prius and, you know, and all of that, and it's just lovely, but, you know, they seem kind of expensive. And also the infrastructures need to be in place because you don't want to drive out somewhere in your electric car and, you know, not have a way of re-energizing, regenerating the electricity in the car. So are we talking about, are there going to be lower cost alternatives to the pricey Prius so that, you know, those of us who are not incredibly wealthy can afford to have an electric car? It's like my first personal question about the question. Where are
we? Well, you know, I think both Betta and I can speak to this. You know, part of the campaign is getting out there with the fact that it's not just your expensive Prius that's available in the world of electric vehicles. You know, most of the major car companies have an electric vehicle to offer.
There's continuously advances in technology with this, with the mileage going further on an electric charge. But we have to start somewhere, and there's plugins, there's plug-in hybrids, so we have a combination of things available to us. We were lucky enough to have Ford donate us a plug-in hybrid to drive across the state as we go on our Road to Renewables tour. So we'll actually be able to, walk the talk, and people can take a look at it. They can get in and test drive it if they want. We're also working with communities to do electric vehicle expos, so people can touch and see and ask questions with owners or car dealerships representatives about these vehicles and how they work. As well as working with elected officials on increasing the infrastructure, which we know having charging stations accessible, wherever people might need them, is a big part of, making electric vehicles accessible and something that people, want to invest in. We're working on a number of fronts, and, there are cheaper options right now. And I think, as the advocacy continues, as the movement building and the awareness and the education continues, you'll see prices drop even further. Just like, with any of emerging technologies we've seen in the past, they always come out as pretty expensive. But the more and more that people are getting in these cars, the more that car dealerships are really getting out there and out in front in the electric vehicle world, the more, the prices come down, the technology advances, we can go further, and we can really start reducing our greenhouse gas emissions from vehicles and the pollution that we're seeing from our vehicles right now, and our dependence on gas and oil. And Beth,
well,
if you want to add anything to that technology.
Another thing that's kind of exciting is, that a lot of people don't know about, is there's up to a $7,500 tax incentive for at the federal level if you buy a plug-in hybrid or electric vehicle. And just recently, New York State passed up to a $2,000 New York State tax rebate. So that's, has the potential to save you almost, $10,000 off of the cost of a new plug-in hybrid. So, of course, getting a used one is also a great opportunity, great option. But having this now new tax rebate is something that Renee and I are going to be promoting around the state. And, once again, is New York State really putting their money where their mouth is and helping to incentivize New Yorkers to make these choices. And so we're excited to participate in this National Drive Electric Week from September 10th to the 18th, doing some events in different parts of the state with test drives and, ride-alongs. And as Renee said, when people can get behind the wheel and, really experience the car, that goes a lot further and kind of turning them on to the whole thing than just hearing about it.
Sure thing. I just have to interject here that as we've been having this discussion, Bernie Sanders walks through the hall here. So, I don't know if there's screams in the background, because I heard people screaming, and I was wondering why they were screaming, and so I sort of looked up and down into the hall, and they were screaming because he was walking through. He put forth in his platform and in his campaign, a really strong argument for pursuing all of these initiatives and all the economic benefits of them. And so what you're doing in New York at New Yorkers for Clean Power is really, in the lead and kind of acting and building out and being a pioneer of, something that's creating both a better sustainable future and a better economic future, for our state and for our country. So that's really, really terrific. Let's talk for just a few minutes here, if we can, about the campaign and about the recent climate march in Philadelphia. here in July of 2016 in the day prior to the Democratic convention. In the time, let me just preface that, and I'd love to hear your experiences of the climate march. Let me just ask, in the time that, you know, you both have been, the considerable amount of time that you both have been participating and organizing around fracking, now clean power and environmental and energy issues, are you, of course, New York State is an unusual state because I believe we are a pioneering state in so many ways, but are you seeing greater awareness? Is there kind of a, do you see the advances in terms of the average people? And, you know, are more people, in your view, kind of open to or inspired by the, you know, kind of renewable energy revolution that a candidate like Bernie Sanders was calling for? You know, do you see that when you're out and about? Or,
Oh, yeah.
I mean, what has changed from when you began?
Well, when we started working on the anti-fracking campaign years and years ago, five, six, 7 years ago, people had no idea what fracking was. There was certainly an environmental movement that exists against coal, against nuclear power, against other dirty infrastructure. But fracking was really a new kid on the block. New York State has a history of activism. It has, we have universities all across the state. We have, the oldest peace council in the nation here in Syracuse, where I'm from. So we have a strong history of an educated populace, of an activated populace. And really, I think we had the perfect storm in New York with the anti-fracking campaign to kind of really bring together this like really massive campaign, obviously, to educate people on what this was rapidly, with the help of like films like Gasland and, other educational tools that came out over the course of us really discovering, having people right across the border in Pennsylvania reaching out and telling us their stories. But that really created, all this is to say, that really created this massive, unprecedented movement in New York State. Betta and I working closely with a coalition that we helped to work with and build called New Yorkers Against Fracking, which led to over 250 organizations, more than 1,500 businesses, more than 300 faith-based leaders, all calling for a ban on fracking and, really putting the scientists and the health professionals out in front to show the statistics on, what this extreme fossil fuel extraction, fracking was doing to the people, to our climate, to our economy, to our just, our future, as a whole. And, with this movement that just, really exploded into, what we saw in the end there with the ban on fracking, thankfully, Governor Cuomo doing the right thing and showing himself as a leader in climate change and in protecting our environment and having a long-term sustainable economy. With the ban on fracking, I think it was a supernatural transition over to the solutions. As we got towards the, years of this campaign with fracking, we all saw that it was critical that we're not just pushing back the fracking and the infrastructure and all the, dirty energy going on right now, on a global national scale, but we have to start implementing and deploying the solutions as quickly as possible at the same exact time. And so I think that the consciousness has, really sparked in that sense where we're all seeing that, yes, we need to keep pushing back. We need to keep holding back the dirty energy in the infrastructure, but we have to simultaneously create and build and deploy the solutions that we need. And that was really the motivator behind this clean energy march that you saw on Sunday, which was amazing, over 10,000 people marching through the streets, uniting from all different, parts of the country, representing all sorts of different groups and individuals and, people representing different communities and causes, nurses, environmental justice organizations, businesses, faith-based leaders, the indigenous community from across, you know, this continent, all coming together with this message of saying no to fossil fuels, no to fracking on a national scale, yes to renewable energy, and to that quick transition to 100% renewable energy, you know, and we were certainly, you know, excited to be a part of that.
And it was happening, ironically, on the hottest, one of the two hottest days on record in the city of Philadelphia. So, you know, the dedication of the people, not only coming from all over to participate and show that this is a critical concern on the eve of the Democratic Convention, but also to endure, you know, this epic a heat wave, which, you know, is not part of the usual past history of weather in this region. It was really pushing up to 100 and above at various points throughout these last 2 days. And, you know, it was very odd weather. There was also, there were thunderstorms without much rain and all kinds of things. And it was almost like, you know, the planet was speaking back and saying, you know, and sort of challenging our dedication in a way, because, you know, only the hardy really could participate in this. But it was also a warning and a reminder, you know, that all of the civilization and everything that we fill our lives with and that we're enjoying and used to is really, you know, upon this foundation that we don't want to be on, you know, in the position of unsettling in order, you know, to meet some short-term profit incentives, you know, of the fossil fuel industry and stuff like that. So, Betta, you know, anything you want to share about that? About the march?
Well, I think,
and all of
you kind of hit the nail on the head as far as the shift that we've seen in the general public in recent years, you know, between Superstorm Sandy and, you know, hotter and hotter summers. You know, I think more people are feeling quite literally the effects of climate change already. And there is a growing awareness that in order to avert, you know, truly catastrophic climate change, we need to act quickly to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. And the kind of most obvious way to do that is transforming our energy system. So, I mean, I'm definitely, you know, feeling a lot more support from the general public, from local elected officials, from, you know, New York State. There's definitely still a lot of, you know, work to be done for New York to truly be the renewable energy leader. We're about to kind of hear the proclamation on the clean energy standard. Next Monday, there's supposed to be a big announcement, and that will determine a lot of things. We were, you know, really advocating for a specific offshore wind here. So there's a lot of good things with the clean energy standard as far as requiring utilities to, you know, purchase a certain amount of power from renewable energy sources, but, you know, needing the state to really make a long-term, large-scale commitment to offshore wind. New York, off the shores of New York City and Long Island are the largest untapped reserves of offshore wind in the world, which is pretty amazing.
Wow.
But if we don't, but if we don't develop that quickly, you know, we will end up seeing, you know, the construction
drilling
of more, you know, gas peaker plants, you know, on Long Island. And so, you know, it's choices like that, you know, we're working to, you know, advocate and build a big movement for, and working with a lot of great partners, pushing for offshore wind. And then also, of course, you know, within the clean energy standard, there's a very likely chance that the administration is going to decide to bail out the nuclear industry to the tune of $7.6 billion. And while that's not focusing on nuclear and focusing on the fossil fuels is not necessarily, you know, the sort of raison d'etre of New Yorkers for Clean Power. We're very much laser focused on the solutions and the renewable energy technologies, but just it's pretty obvious that if we're spending $7.6 billion over the next, you know, 12 years on the nuclear industry, that money is not going to be going towards expanding geothermal. It's not going to be going towards, you know, more incentives for energy efficiency and solar and making, you know, renewable energy technologies more affordable. So that's definitely something that's, you know, I think top of mind
for us and for the movement for truly renewable energy.
In other words,
important.
We're at a choice point here. And, and if we want the choice to go the right way, we have to be, everyone has to kind of all hands on deck to participate in that. How do people, we're coming to the end, the last few minutes of our show here, how do people connect with you, get involved, look into it for themselves, support what you're doing? Like, where do they go?
Yeah. Well, I encourage everyone to go to our website, which is nyforcleanpower.org. We're going to continue to, as we go along the rest of this year, promote events that we're going to have, more information about all of these different issues that we've been talking about and the different campaigns that exist across, and funding that exists across the state. We encourage you to like our page on Facebook. We are New Yorkers for Clean Power on Facebook. We encourage you to follow us on Twitter at NY4CleanPower. You can also check out our Ford Fusion Energy plug-in hybrid that we've been driving across the state on our Road to Renewables tour. And we're also on Instagram at NY4CleanPower. Follow us.
And feel free to email us.
Yeah.
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 You can
go to the website and you can email them. Yeah, that'll be great. Okay. Thank you so much, you guys. We've been talking with Betta Broad and Renee Vogelsang of New Yorkers for Clean Power on today's Connect the Dots. If you're in the region, you absolutely should get involved because, as much as we have to stop the forms of costly and destructive energy that we are now invested in, we have to start the new forms that we need, and we need to do both simultaneously because there has to be a shift in investment to really save the planet and to move in a positive direction. I want to thank you both for being on the show, Renee and Betta, as well as thank you personally from the bottom of my heart for the work that you have done and that you continue to do. I have to say that, you both inspire me tremendously. And when I think of my own work, in this area to raise awareness and reach out and all of that and what we need to do, I think of you guys. I really do. And I feel like how fortunate our movement is to have such kind and caring, talented and brilliant young warriors. So when I think of female leadership, women leaders, I think of you all. And, thank you for what you do. And we'll have you back on again and talk more about these issues. I really mean it. And, in fact, I don't usually tell you, but I tell other people about you guys.
The feeling is definitely mutual. Thank you for being such a voice, for change and all of your amazing work to raise awareness about these issues and, connect the dots and, be in the streets and everything you do to bring your energy and intellect to this movement. It's such an honor to, be your friend and be with you in this movement. We're going to win.
We're going to win. And, that's one of the things I tell people who are not engaged, which is if you have the blessing and luck to work in community, to build your community, to connect with people you're in your community, it's really half the battle. And it's not a work of anger. It's really a work of love. So that's my experience. Anyway, we have to sign off now because they'll start playing the music on us here, but we'll have you back to the show. Thank you so much for being with us today. And thank you, listeners, for being with me and with Betta and Renee of New Yorkers for Clean Power for another edition of Connect the Dots. And we'll be back with you next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.